We're joined right now by Graham Boley, and Graham is author of a brand new book called No Way Down. This book is a very gripping new book about the 2008 climbing tragedy on K2, the second highest mountain in the world, in which 11 climbers died. Graham, welcome to the Roadhouse.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you aboard. I guess my first question for you, Graham, is I didn't really introduce you in fully. You also are a reporter and editor in the business section of the New York Times.
Right, a reporter here. Yeah, I'm a reporter here. The
connection is not real clear between what you normally do, which is involves the business area, and mountaineering, which, as I understand it, you haven't been a mountaineer, and I'm not sure how much interest you had in it prior to getting an assignment for an article on a major tragedy.
That's right. I mean, that was the whole point. I actually, before I was a business writer, I was on the foreign desk here, so I covered foreign news. And this story happened very early one morning, sort of like 6 a.m. here, when I was sitting here on the foreign desk in New York. The news came across about people stranded at the top of K2, and I was asked to cover it from here. And I called the mountain, and I reached climbers who were coming down out of this disaster on their satellite phones. Many have satellite phones, and I built this story, which a day later they put on the page one of the Times. And with that, I sort of stepped into this whole new world, which was alien to me. You know, you're right, I hadn't been interested in climbing, but I stepped like into a foreign country of the mountaineer, and I learned about K2, this terrific but murderous mountain in northern Pakistan, but one of the most dangerous in the world, and the people who were drawn to it down the years, down through its history, but then specifically in 2008. And I set out to interview everybody that had been on the mountain in that season, the survivors and the families of people who had died, to try and reconstruct what exactly had happened, and to understand why people put themselves in such danger to achieve this goal of climbing the second tallest mountain in the world.
What was your initial reaction when you got the assignment, Graham? As I said, it was a little foreign maybe from what you normally do.
Right. I must admit, I kind of wondered why we should care. And I wrote a few pieces in the Times about, this is all well and good, and it's a great kind of personal odyssey for people, but what was the broader resonance? This is a very different era to the one in the 40s and 50s, when these mountains like Everest and K2 in 1954 were climbed for the first time. Then it mattered for whole nations. We all sat around, my father would tell about sitting around listening to when they conquered Everest. But today, there is not that broader resonance. And so this story became also, this story became me kind of, as I spend a lot of time with these people, and also went to K2 myself in Pakistan, in northern Pakistan, was coming to a kind of a realization that there is a broader meaning, understanding why people climb, why they do it, and I can see now that it is for a broader goal.
Can you give people in our audience a brief outline of what actually happened and what made this different from many other tragedies that have happened in mountaineering?
Yes, in the summer of 2008, so 2 years ago, about 30 climbers were on the mountain K2 in northern Pakistan on the border with China, and it's slightly shorter than Everest. Only a few hundred feet, but it's far more dangerous, and it attracts a different sort of climber. It's far more distant, harder to get to than Everest, and it attracts only the best climbers in the world. It really is a dangerous and a tough climb. It's far steeper than Everest. The climbing is really difficult right from the bottom to the top. It's further north than Everest, and it's subject to these kind of very unpredictable storms and winds, and down the years, people have been blown off near the summit. There's sort of only roughly 300 people have ever climbed K2, whereas thousands have climbed Everest, and 70 people have died, which, given that statistic, almost one in four, if you go to the mountain, that one in four statistic is in people's minds. It's quite a frightening one, yet still people go. And indeed, they'd gone there in the summer of 2008 from different national expeditions. There were Norwegians and Dutch, Koreans, a Frenchman, an American team, a Serbian team. Because of the bad weather, they'd all been pinned down on the lower slopes for most of the summer and hadn't been able to go for the summit. But on August the 1st, the skies cleared and it was a stunning, beautiful day. And they'd managed to get up to Camp 4, which is the final camp before the summit. And they set off to take on the mountain. They thought that they, because they hadn't been able to go singly, they all went together. So now there was this kind of crush of 30 climbers, and they thought that great number would add, that cooperation would be add to their advantage and be their strength, but it worked against them. Very soon it became clear that this was too many people, and it was very crowded, it was very hot, and they had to navigate two great obstacles which lie just below the summit of K2, very famous. One is called the Bottleneck, which is a very narrow gully, a couple of hundred feet high, dirty rocks and stone, quite steep. And then this is below an overhanging glacier, a huge kind of tottering frozen wave which hangs out over the summit, just below the summit, over the Bottleneck, called the Serac. And the climbers had to go up this very narrow gully and cross underneath the Serac. But in the overcrowded conditions, very early on in the morning, two collided on the Bottleneck, and a Serbian climber called Dren Mandic, fell to his death. And a second climber, a Pakistani porter, there were porters and Sherpas amongst the climbers, went down to try and rescue this person, the Serbian, and as they dragged the body down, the Pakistani porter slipped. So by about midday on that morning, already two people had died. But it was a measure of how much these climbers wanted to carry on. You know, some would say foolhardy, but these people had invested, you know, years of their life and much money and hope and dreams in getting to the summit, that they carried on. And they went up in a line up the Bottleneck and crossed underneath this terrifying Serac and came out onto the summit snowfields and then kind of waded knee-deep through the snow for another 3 hours and finally got to the summit. They'd all set this deadline of reaching the summit by about 3 o'clock because they wanted to get there and then back down before it got dark. This was sort of an iron rule that they all pronounced that they believed in, but actually the final climbers didn't reach it until 8 p.m. This didn't diminish their joy. You know, the way they describe it in the photos and the videos I've seen is much joy of raising national flags and pumping of the air and calling home on the satellite phones from the summit. But it was late. It was getting dark. It was a beautiful kind of sunset, pink skies over the Karakoram Mountains, the Western Himalayas. But although it was late, they had great confidence that they would be okay and be okay coming down from K2 because they'd set ropes, fixed ropes, from Camp 4 all the way up the Bottleneck and across the Serac as they came up underneath the Serac. So they thought they could climb back down to the Serac, this glacier, clip onto the ropes, and go down safely, like as on sort of like a tram line, even if it was dark and cold and freezing and they were almost out of oxygen. But that's when the real tragedy struck. The Serac collapsed as they were coming down, and it killed a great Norwegian climber in front of his wife as they came down. They were the first to kind of come down onto the ropes and also swept away these fixed ropes that everybody else was depending on. And that's, as they came down one by one, they were faced by that prospect of coming down now from the top of K2 in the freezing temperatures very late at night, after three deaths now, without fixed ropes, and some would survive and some wouldn't.
You know, that I found to be really a gripping, dramatic part of your whole book. The first two folks that died, virtually died because of the difficulty of the mountain and the steepness, and that accidents plus the high altitude can happen to anybody there. But the number of other climbers that died because of that amazingly bad luck of having that Serac fall at that time when they're high on the mountain. I also really appreciated the technique you use throughout your book, much like Into Thin Air, where you follow the threads of each of many of the climbers going up and down the mountain, their backgrounds, their feelings, their thoughts. It really fleshes out the whole book, Graham.
Thank you, yeah. I really wanted to take, I wanted to take myself as I kind of learned about this world, but then in the book, I wanted to take readers into this world and into this adventure and, you know, show what happened, show what this amazing brave, it was a tale, you're very right, it was a tale of, you know, human error, but also natural disaster, and show it through the different people's minds and experiences, and they each experienced it in different ways, and then this when they came down to face the prospect of the ropes were gone, they each had to confront it in their own different ways, and they were all amazing people. I was really drawn into this. One of the reasons I was really drawn into it as I progressed in my research for the book was, you know, each of them were different in different ways and had come to the mountain for different reasons. There was a 61-year-old Frenchman called Hugues d'Orberade from Lyon, who was a grandfather, and he'd come for three successive years to take on K2. It meant so much to him, and he'd left his sort of daughters and grandchild at home and had come for this third year. And he faced this prospect. He'd reached the top, came down. He died. And so I wanted to situate the story very much. And you know, it was their story. I wasn't there. But many people were so gracious to allow me into their story and tell me their thoughts and as I pieced it all together. But ultimately, it was their story, and I wanted very much for it to be told from their point of view.
I'd like to leave the details just for a moment to talk about a general question, and that has to do with, what is it about mountaineering and mountaineering stories that capture everybody's attention so much more than other dangerous things that happen in our lives, other stories out there, whether it's firefighters or other things that are maybe, and oftentimes is equally dangerous, but yet if you want to write a really good best-selling book, mountaineering is where to be right now.
That's a really interesting observation. I think this is about people under pressure doing amazing things and being asked to do their utmost. You know, the people that were caught in that situation were pushed to the extremes. And they're doing it in a place that most of us will never go to. A very beautiful place. You know, I went there last summer. I had to go for the book, and just getting there through Pakistan was a terrific adventure, and quite, you know, I was very anxious because of the civil war. So people pass through a lot of things to get there, and then you trek out from very poor villages through the glacier in this amazingly blasted terrain. So it's a very alien environment, but then when you arrive there, you know, chest pounding under this amazingly blue sky on the border with China, and you see this mountain. It's very captivating, and I think that must be a reason as well. You're taking readers to a place they are very much out of the ordinary, which they will possibly never see, but can see here in this book. And then also these principles of it, perhaps, you know, firefighting, if you're saving somebody else's life, there's a reason for that. Sometimes there's not a reason for it. It's hard to understand why people, I couldn't understand it to begin with, why people would do this to themselves. Then I began to see, and I think that's another reason why these stories are attractive, and it's not just a story, this is real life. There was a husband and wife, Cecilia and Rolf, were there, and they played out their relationship, and Rolf died. But they played out their relationship on the mountain. It's where they could be together. One of the big themes in the story were people kind of leave family behind, and there's a massive tension I found in everybody I spoke to about families, parents, children left behind, spouses. But this couple, they were able to be together on the mountain, and they had amazing kind of the sociology of that, and they're an amazingly bright couple who attracted people in base camp who came around and watched videos on their Apple Mac in the tent, and they had a sofa that an inflatable sofa where everybody would come sit on and talk. But then Rolf would die, which was very sad. But I think also the characteristics of the people, the particular people that are attracted to this, who are really out of the ordinary and larger than life.
So basically, it's the drama that can be created, or is it the maybe the mystery of a mountain that attracts everybody's attention as well. It as a symbol of extreme difficulty. Is that somewhere along the lines as well?
I think you're putting it very well. It's that mystery of the second tallest mountain in the world. This is the second tallest mountain, and the most, and far more dangerous than Everest. So this is this has a meaning for everybody. I think it's our world, it's our mountain, and then it's the drama of that extreme drama of people trapped in this unspeakably difficult place without, as you pointed out, oxygen. This at these altitudes, the oxygen in the air is much diminished, and people only have a certain amount of time they can survive in that arena. And so you've got this clock ticking, temperatures dropping. It's very intense. And, some people who were there in 2008 in the book, they don't survive. But some do. And they come down the next day. One person is actually forced to spend two nights out in the open. And he loses all his toes from frostbite. But he calls his wife in the Netherlands. He's Dutch. And she helps him down, guides him down via satellite phone. So there's that drama as well.
You mentioned earlier the French, and I can't pronounce his name. You did it very well.
Hugh Gilbert, yeah.
Yes, and I think he was like 61 or 62. He's a grandfather. He's got a wife at home and kids, of course. And some may say, I love mountaineering myself, and I love reading those books. I loved your book. It was very dramatic, very well done. But when you talk to folks, some people say it's a selfish hobby or a selfish effort in the sense that you're leaving behind a possibility of leaving behind grandkids and a wife with no husband. And I know one of the more famous mountaineers out there, with one of the first to climb an 8,000 peak called Annapurna, Lionel Touré of France. He wrote a book called Conquistadors of the Useless. There are thoughts out there that maybe it could be a little selfish. What are your thoughts after you got close to these climbers?
I'm glad there are people doing this because they're conquering something in themselves. I really am glad. And I think that adds something for all of us. They're pushing themselves to the limit. They're doing it in an astoundingly beautiful place. I had my, as I went to K2 last year, I remember trekking in over the glacier through the Karakoram, and I was with some mountaineers who were going to the Gesherbrum Mountain near K2. And I remember asking one, I think he was a German, I said, why do you do this? I can't understand. Why are you going to do this? And he just pointed around at this parade of tremendously beautiful peaks that sort of led into the distance. And he says, isn't it obvious? And I looked, and for a moment it was. What I was the one that was going to leave this and go back to my sort of 9-to-5 job in New York, and he had decided to make sacrifices in his own life and impose them on others. True, but in his own life, he kind of chosen this life to be in this sort of amazingly beautiful place. So I think there is a great personal benefit. I think there is a benefit for all of us. And also, this thing is immensely, you know this better than I do, but this seemed to me an immensely social pursuit as well as being very selfish in the end. Ultimately, these people are on their own and they had to survive on their own. But in the weeks and months before, they'd been together in this kind of great encampment at the mountain, on the glacier at the bottom, and they'd spent weeks and months just talking and chatting, getting to know each other. And for many, I know, getting to know some of these climbers, that was one of the biggest attractions, you kind of with other people.
Graham, was this your first book?
It is, yeah.
And as I've read the book, I'm so impressed by your style and the way that you've played out the drama and followed the threads of the individual climbers. It had to be real rewarding to you, but also coming from a business background and not a mountaineering background, and we don't have a lot of time here, Graham, but what were the most difficult hurdles for you to get around in order to feel that you're really doing this right?
Right. Well, thank you. I think finding time to do it was very hard.
Yeah.
Early in the mornings at 5 a.m. I was getting up, and we had a baby at the time, so that stopped a lot of those hours. But the biggest thing was stepping into the world and getting people to talk to me as an outsider. And I'm so grateful that in the end people did. And most, you know, almost everybody was so willing to, in the end, tell me their story. So that was the most difficult. You know, I went to the first trip I took, went to the funeral, the wake of the an Irishman who died at 35, Gerard MacDonald. And I went to Ireland and I went to this wake of thousands of, 2,000 people in the rain in the west of Ireland in this little village. And that was very difficult reporting with my notebook to try and ask them about this son and brother who had died. But that was repeated in different degrees as I went around. Everybody was in the end so willing to tell me, you know, about themselves and about people who had died, their loved ones who had died.
We've been speaking with Graham Boley, and Graham has completed a book called No Way Down, and that book is a gripping drama about life and death on K2 that happened in 2008 when 11 climbers died. Graham, I want to thank you so much for your time here that you've given us here at the Roadhouse. And for our first book, it's tremendous. This can be found, of course, anywhere that books are sold, online, in your favorite bookstore, wherever folks want to go look for it. Did you develop a website folks can go to, or where can they find out more about the book than they might have heard here today?
There is a website, and thank you very much for your kind words, and thanks for having me. There is a website, and it's called www.nowaydownthebook.com, and it has some photographs from the actual climb, taken by the actual climbers, and they kind of gave me these photographs, and I think they're really terrific, from the actual day, so they're amazing. You can see people going up K2 on that morning, up the bottleneck and to the summit. And there is also some video as well, which is terrific, taken by a Swedish climber who was part of actually the American team, and that's really amazing. I'd take a look at that if you can.
Well, great. Graham, again, I want to thank you so much, and good luck with the follow-up on this book and whatever your next endeavor is.
Thank you so much.